You are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Road. Each week, we design new decks for tournament play. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. Coming up on the roundup, the impact of Lightning Bolt on Modern, plus our picks of the week. Then on the flashback, testing results with Astral Drift. Finally on the brew session, new decks with Seagate Stormcaller in Modern and Pioneer. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 83 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson. I am joined, as always, by my guy on the West Coast, Damon Alexander. Damon, what is going on?
Hey, welcome to December. Had some sunny weather here, but man, this year has gone fast.
You think so? I'd say it's like people with kids always say, the days have been long, but the year has gone fast.
Well, I feel like March felt like it took about 12 months of the year, and everything else is compressed into the remaining nothingness.
And we are, of course, joined by the CEO of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. He is Mr. Dan Shriver. Dan, how's life?
Hey, David. Yeah, I'm doing well. I got to disagree with Damon. This year has not gone fast. This has been the longest year of my entire life.
Oh, I think the first half went really, really slow. I think the last few months has been really fast. At least November has been, after the election kind of stuff died down.
I agree that it's been the longest year of your life.
Is that a burn? I'm not even sure.
It's like the Counting Crow said, man, it's been a long December, but there's reason to believe maybe next year will be better than this one.
It's only December 1st. My God, it's already been the longest December, the longest December 1st of my life.
My computer shows it as December 2nd because whenever I reboot from Linux into Windows, it thinks it's 3 a.m. So living in the future over here.
One thing that is dragging on forever is Zendikar Rising season. I don't really know why, but it feels like the last 2-3 years, there's been like this deluge of new sets, new product releases, and it's kept us on our toes as Modern Pioneer players.
Oh, there was a release. Commander Legends.
Right, but it wasn't for us, for like tournament one-on-one play.
Oh, Hull Breacher is tearing up a storm in Legacy.
What does Hull Breacher do?
It basically is like a Narset-type effect to stop card draw. 2 and a blue for a 3-2 flash, and if your opponent would draw a card beyond the first of their draw step, kind of like Notion Thief, you make a treasure instead. And so in Legacy, there was a deck that used to play Narset plus Echo of Eons plus Lion's Eye Diamond and Karn and Mox, like Lotus Petals and things like that. And so you just sort of play LED, discard your hand, recast Echo of Eons. And the deck actually just sort of chain this together multiple times sometimes. But now when we have a Hull Breach route, instead of just making so the opponent can't draw more than one card in the turn cycle, you actually just get 7 treasures, which makes it even easier to keep going as you wheel. That I call plays Urza as a mana sink. And so Hull Breacher slots in as an easy 4-of, and that's part of why it's like 100 ticks online right now.
And the crazy thing is all those treasures make Urza's little friend, like, it just ends the game so fast. It's crazy. Urza makes like a 12-12.
Yeah, card's good. But yeah, not for Modern, it's true, or Pioneer.
Echo of Eons is legal in Modern, and I've often wondered if there was some kind of other way to build a draw sevens deck. We've explored like the Narset Days Undoing thing, which doesn't actually let them draw 7. But what if you're just like trying to just draw 7 and you don't care whether they draw or not because you're, you know, playing out your hand. Maybe it's full of Moxen and 0 drops and you're generating all this mana. Is that possible in Modern?
It doesn't sound like it, but you don't have Mox Opal, you don't have Lion's Eye Diamond, you don't have Lotus Petal.
Well, you have Lotus Bloom, you have Mox Amber, Mox Tantalite. You have Simeon Spirit Guide, you have Urza. Just stop me when I've assembled a deck.
I mean, these are all legal cards that go into a deck that is Modern legal.
Smothering Tithe is like a Modern legal Hull Breacher. It's basically the same card.
Well, I mean, Narset is the Modern legal Hull Breacher, to be fair, or Notion Thief.
Okay. Just thinking out loud, doing a little warm-up brewing before we get to the actual good decks of the week. But all right, I'll save my best ideas for later in the cast.
I mean, Hullbrasher would be a pretty serious upgrade to the Notion Thief deck. I mean, the one mana off, the extra point of toughness. And then I think it's actually weirdly better to make treasures and to draw to 14 cards in hand to just discard a bunch. Seven treasures is no joke.
Right, and I mean, you can do that in Modern with Smothering Tithe and, say, Reforge the Soul, for example. People have attempted decks like this. I've never seen one that was actually good enough to get published, but it's an interesting space to play in.
Yeah. But yeah, it's true. Besides Commander Legends, I mean, there's Secret Lairs and stuff, but those don't really fill the scratch the itch either.
Yeah, I think the next set doesn't even come out until February, so it's not like we're just waiting until the new year. I mean, we're still 3 or 2 full months and a change away.
Yeah, I will say that Commander Legends is one of the best Pai Gow sets I've ever played, along with Ultimate Masters. Pai Gow, for those of you that haven't played it, is a fun, kind of casual way to crack a pack of cards with a friend. yeah, so with Pai Gow, you take a pack of 15 cards, and you build 5 decks of 3, and then your opponent does the same, and you roll a die to figure out which of your 5 decks is playing against their 5 decks. And then it's basically just you have infinite mana. And so, for example, a card like Fireball, you would say, hey, I Fireball you for 1,000,000. And both players start at 5 life, and you just do it where the loser picks to be on the play. And so obviously some formats have cards that are stupid. Like, for example, we played some Fate Reforged, and there's like a 5-power Hasty Dragon at common, so you just play that and win. Valkyr Invoker is 8 mana, deal 3 damage, so that's also kind of a dumb card. But it's a fun way to crack packs. You know, if you've downed some at a GP or whatever and you have some prize wall packs, or you just take a box home and want to crack packs in a way that's a little bit more productive than cracking by yourself and a little bit less productive than drafting. And with Commander of Legends, the mechanics line up really well for this format. So the Unearth equivalent of Encore is pretty good. Sometimes you actually want to kill your own creature on turn 1 so you can Encore it with haste. And generally speaking, the cards lead to interesting grindy things. Monarch is a useless mechanic, but the rest of them are pretty good. And because it's a 20-card pack, what my friend and I did was we would build 15-card decks. You get to cut the 5 worst, which would lead to very intricate game state situations where you really have to go deep in the decision trees to figure out like who could win from a certain board state.
I've played a little bit of Pai Gow in my time. It's an interesting format and a cool way to take just 2 booster packs and make like a series of mini puzzles to solve. I'm not quite sure that I would call it magic per se. It's a little bit more like a jigsaw puzzle or something, or a logic puzzle. And like you're saying, you don't even have to play the games out. You just sort of like talk through what would happen and declare a winner in each mini heads up match. From that perspective, I feel like just straight up pack war is the closest thing you can get to real magic fun from 2 packs. But that does take a lot longer.
Yeah, I think that the skills are sort of resemblant of real magic. There's a lot of bluffing if you have like the last card in hand. Frequently, your opponent will have kind of one of two decisions. They just have to make a read on you or vice versa. There's a lot of creature combat, attacking, blocking. And the nice thing is, because it's such a simpler environment than a normal game of Magic where people have a lot more cards in their hand or in their deck, you're in a very small universe with a total of 6 cards total between the two of you, that you can solve the game state to a much greater degree than normal Magic. But this is just a good exploration of going down decision trees to do a case we actually can solve it to completion versus Magic where you just have to estimate and see what happened and try to also not really see what happened when it comes to results-oriented thinking.
Well, now, hang on a sec. So you're saying that you actually have the cards hidden in your hand?
Yeah.
Maybe I've played a different variant where you just flip all the cards at once.
Oh, no, you just have you start with a hand of 3 cards and you play them as you would normal Magic, but with infinite mana.
Well, something to keep us busy, keep our minds sharp through the long December and the long January before call time comes out. Speaking of other things to keep our minds sharp, let's get to our housekeeping. We do have 2 new patrons we want to welcome at the top. They are Grandpa Schizo and John G. Thank you very much for joining the Faithless Brewing family.
It's always great to read 2 names back to back and someone does like a funny internet name and then the other person just puts their real name.
Isn't Grandpa Schizo a totally normal name? I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I think John G was the ironic name.
Normcore. John G.
Thank you very much to our newest members of the Faithless Brewing family. As a reminder to anyone, if you'd like to support what we do at the cast, Patreon is a fantastic way to do so, to give a little bit back, help us keep the lights on. You get some fun benefits in exchange as our way of saying thanks. Everyone who joins gets access to our patron Discord. You also get some bonus content every week in the form of our show outline. We call it the extended show notes. There's also, at the higher tiers, merchandise that you can get as well if you want to represent some Faithless Brewing swag. We have playmats, we have custom tokens, and from time to time, we even have some ways that you can help us figure out what to do next. We are currently going through a round of voting for the next card that we will feature. Last week, we talked through the cards that were nominated by people in our Discord. I think there were 17 nominees overall. And yeah, the voting is... it's a tight race right now. I think as of today, it looks like it's headed towards a runoff, actually. Five different cards are all within one vote of each other. We'll have to see how that goes. We might have a Georgia-style runoff coming up here this weekend to determine next week's card.
Where I accuse you guys both of, like, sedition and not counting the votes correctly. And midnight voter dumps coming in. And
I've already called for Damon to resign. He's administered this quite shamefully. Another thing that we do from time to time, we have a community league, which is just a fun way to play a little bit of friendly Magic with some like-minded brewers. And we just wrapped up the final week of Season 4. This season, we've been playing Modern. The first 2 weeks were just regular Modern. The third week, we played Budget Modern. The shout out to Emma Partlow from TCG Player for inspiring us to sort of think a little bit outside the box and inside the wallet. And then for the fourth week, the final week is always chosen by the winner of the previous community league. Mr. Rabe, who had won Season 3, asked us to play 2014 Modern, a return to the Splinter Twin, Pod, and Tarmogoyf era. That was a fun week for sure. I got a chance to cast a bunch of Gataxian probes. Always a good time. When all the dust had settled, we had our champion of Season 4 is Georgie Boy 39, who had a stellar 7-1 record. So congrats to Georgie Boy. Interesting thing is that George ended up playing Lightning Bolt decks for all 4 weeks of this league. When asked about his selections, he said that he feels like Modern's in a good place when Bolt is the most played card. So George played Breach in week one, and then a really cool red-green prison deck in week two. Damon, do you want to tell us a little bit about this red-green list?
Yeah, so it's kind of like a Ponza list featuring Arbor Elves and Utopia Sprawls and Blood Moons and Bolts and even Chandras and Renin Sixes. And that's where it goes a little bit different. It plays four Karn the Great Creator along with three Ensnaring Bridge main and one sideboard, along with some Maze Might Tomes and some Renin Sixes and Clothis and Valakut Exploration to keep the fuel going, along with just a nice Karn Wishboard featuring the, you know, Torpor Orb to screw up the Ephemerate type deck, Liquid Metal Coating to mess up anybody's mana base, Grafdigger's Cage against the graveyard stuff, just to, you know, the usual tools.
When I hear prison, I would normally expect Simeon Spirit Guides and Chalice of the Void and some way to maybe like cheese out a win. And that's not really what this deck is doing. It has some elements of that in the form of the four Blood Moons main, the three Ensnaring Bridge main, plus the four Karns to get more Ensnaring Bridges. So there's definitely that, but it's not going so hard on like denying the opponent their spells.
Yeah, this one, instead of going down on cards with Spirit Guide, goes up on cards with Maze Mind Tomes, the exact opposite approach. And so I think game one, it looks to just really lean on Ensnaring Bridge, which a lot of decks are between pretty cold to extremely cold to. And then you always have Karn to dig for Silver Bullets against whatever your opponent's on. And Blood Moon can also knock out a big chunk of decks, or at least severely cripple them. And game two, it seems like a trickier story here, but your opponents will come prepared with the right sort of interaction.
Yeah, that's always the risk when you're playing a deck that relies on just sort of having permanence in play. They'll see what you're up to. If they break through it, I mean, that was your line of defense. So I'm not sure how this would go, although George did say that the deck is sweet, and he highly recommends taking it through a league if you want to, quote, farm some tickets. In the 2014 Modern Week, interesting build here, an attempt at Grixis Shadow at a time when, I guess, Death Shadow as we understand it had not really been invented yet. So this was a case where it's like the cards seem to have been there. The cards that we think of now as like the staples of Death Shadow were mostly all legal. There was even Gataxian Probe, which was legal and perhaps underplayed then. So I think the question that George is trying to explore, and I ended up exploring something similar for this week myself, did people just sort of miss this style of Shadow deck? We talked about how Death Shadow Zoo was a more popular use of the card at the time. So I'm curious what you guys think about this collection of creatures and spells here. The main change would be that you have to play Tombstalker instead of Gurmag Angler, or you have to splash for Tarmogoyf.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like Tombstalker is a substantial step down from Gurmag Angler, but otherwise it seems like a pretty reasonable Death Shadow deck from about a year ago.
Stubborn Denial was not yet printed.
Oh, that's a big loss. Good point.
Correct. Yeah, the Stubborn Denial and Fatal Push.
Yeah, and Colgan's Command is like a one or two of.
Yeah, those are all... Stubborn Denial seems to me the bigger loss. I'm not sure you miss Fatal Push that much. The Spell Sky is a two of is kind of interesting.
You probably do miss Fatal Push against the Twin decks.
Well, you have Spellscape for that.
True.
I think the deck looks fine. I mean, yeah, I think this is a deck that was missed. You know, when Death Shadow started being successful, of course, all the pros said it was just a meme or whatever. Until then, LSV was saying Death Shadow should get banned. So this is the cycle with Modern, is these decks aren't real until... The pros kind of go through the modified Gandhi cycle where they're laughing at you and then they're arguing with you and then they're saying your deck should be banned. Why isn't Wizards taking action? So
makes me wonder, like, if there's a deck like this that we're missing right now.
Yeah. I mean, I think when you see Aspiring Spike or whatever develop multiple decks that become mainstays or F-Pauls with the green-white Titan, you know, that was a joke until it was the best Titan deck probably in the format. So there are people doing that all the time. The same with Niv-Mizzet. You know, people thought it was like a meme, and then it was arguments about how to build it. And then it was, man, we need to... Some of the cards of the deck got banned, not specifically because of Niv-Mizzet, of course, but...
Thinking about the impact of like a format like 2014 Modern where you don't have Fatal Push, and this comment from George about how Lightning Bolt was sort of the unifying card for all four of his Community League decks, and how Modern is great when Lightning Bolt is the best card or when Lightning Bolt is the most played card, kind of makes me wonder, like, what exactly is the impact of Lightning Bolt in particular on a format? Thinking here of, like, David, how you've often said that in Pioneer, because there is no Lightning Bolts, you know, aggro is just doomed to suck.
Well, it's not that aggro is doomed to suck. It's that specific principles are not being used. So when the best burn spell is the front half of Bone Crusher, that is a pretty big change. So you're paying twice the mana for two-thirds of the damage. I mean, when Bolt is good, and it is currently the most played card in Modern, it is most often going to the face. And so the reason it's played so much now is not because, I mean, obviously it can kill creatures, but blue-red prowess, blue-black prowess. Lightning Bolt is a card that can be used as removal, but what it does is it just takes a reasonable percentage of your opponent's life with it. And that threat causes people to build their decks a certain way. They have to interact a certain way. When you have people that are playing multiple colors, so like the Omnath decks, they are favoring Path over Bolt. Because when they're willing to go long, Bolt is no longer killing the creatures that they're worried about.
Yeah, depending on the state of the format, Bolt can either be kind of kill almost everything of relevance, or it can kill like a pretty small subset of the relevant creatures. So obviously against a mono white taxes list in Modern, Bolt can basically kill anything. Same against Burn. But against Prowess, all of a sudden it can miss on Bedlam Reveler, misses on any of the Death Shadow big creatures or Tarmogoyfs. So in that sense, yeah, like the benefit of Bolt is that it goes face.
The question comes up, I think, oftentimes a reference to Standard, where people are sort of clamoring for Lightning Bolt or a similar card to be put into Standard, and then Mark Rosewater or someone else will have to say, oh, no, we can't do that because blank. And I'm kind of wondering, like, what is the reason exactly? Is it that they're afraid that it would make creatures... Lightning Bolt would just horrendously warp what creatures you can play, because two toughness versus three toughness versus four toughness just is too punishing of a design constraint. You can't play creatures when Lightning Bolt is legal in a format like Standard. And I'm not even sure if that's true or not. We haven't tested it in a long time. Hearing what you guys are saying about how Lightning Bolt mostly goes to the face in Modern makes me wonder if maybe it wouldn't actually be treated as like a removal spell per se, but more of an aggressive tool. And then you can shift the question to like Pioneer or Historic and ask the same question there.
I mean, I would say it mostly goes to the face. It's just that in the matchups where it isn't useful, a Lightning Bolt deck will be happiest if it is aggressive. And so if they have like a big Goyf, you have the reach to go past it with your Bolt. Whereas a Blue Moon deck needs to figure out like a different way around the Goyf. Whereas like a Jeskai control deck or whatever just paths the Goyf. But yeah, I mean, some of the recent Standard formats, like the ones where people were casting Genesis Ultimatums on turn three and just dumping millions of Omnaths and things onto the board, like, it's not even clear the Bolt would have been all that good.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem with Standard is that they don't print actual good one-drops. Bolt is a one-drop, but I'm talking about one-drop creatures. I mean, they push planeswalkers, and so to compete with the planeswalkers, they had to push the creatures, and then the spells are just lagging woefully behind. So they just made a series of choices because they wanted to sell planeswalkers, and that is what haunted Standard.
Yeah, you need to have like a good one-drop removal spell to kill the Gilded Goose or, you know, Llanowar Elf type cards of the world. But you need to also have it scale a bit better late game than just a shock. And so it's almost like if you had like a card that was like a, you know, one red for a shock or maybe like a kicker to deal more damage late game, that'd be a pretty good card to introduce to the format. But of course, once you introduce a burn spell that's better, it never goes away. And so you're stuck with it in Pioneer forever.
Do you care to hazard a guess as to what would happen if Lightning Bolt were just introduced to Pioneer next week? Pioneer Masters, Secret Lair, Pioneer Christmas or something?
The format would feel a lot more adult, I'll say that much. Casting Shock just feels like so sad.
And you notice, like, the red decks that have succeeded have basically found a way to not play Shock. So, like, the red-white Wizards list that Cedric Phillips played all these Wizards just to play the Wizard spell, and then they were playing white specifically just for Boros Charm. There's basically no other white card in the entire 75, except for Lurrus, which is, I guess, technically in the 75. It exists outside of the normal 75. So yeah, that's how bad Shock is. Like, the entire deck was contorted to play the absolute minimum amount of Shocks needed to compete. Even your blue-red list, Dan, that gets value out of just random cardboard that has one mana instant or sorcery on it, just did not play that many Shocks at the end of the day because the card is just so anemic.
Yeah, I guess if you like Shock, you can play up to 8 of them in Pioneer.
You can play up to 8 Shocks, and nobody does that. I mean,
I was playing 4 Wild Slash and, like, 2 Spikefield Hazard, somehow even worse than Shock. That never got played as a land, so I don't know what I was even doing.
Yeah, if you draw your 8 Shocks, you still can't kill your opponent with them.
Well, interesting sort of theoretical discussion. Every once in a while, it becomes, like, not theoretical. Like, in Historic, they added the Jumpstart set to Historic, and Jumpstart has Lightning Bolt in it, but then they just specifically excluded Lightning Bolt from the digital implementation of Historic. So someone's thinking about this question somewhere in back offices of WotC, but I guess it's unlikely to come up for Pioneer, at least, until Pioneer Masters, whenever that happens.
Yeah, you know, the Bolt test was a lot more important before there was a bunch of other great removal. You know, so Path is not a great removal on mana creatures. Bolt is a fine piece of removal for that. And then there was, like, the mid-range stuff. The fact that Bolt killed Wild Nacatl meant it was functionally not that much better, or maybe worse than Goblin Guide or whatever. And then Goyf passing the Bolt test before Fatal Push existed is the whole reason that Jund was so good back then. And the fact that Fatal Push exists has really made Jund much worse. Even though it can play the full playset of Fatal Push itself, its threat package is incredibly anemic to these super efficient threats. Goyf is actually losing a mana in almost every exchange, which is just a total switch from how Jund used to play.
I thought that was an interesting sort of takeaway from this implementation of the Community League. And again, shout outs to GeorgieBoy39. So with all that said, let's move on to our picks of the week. Damon, what do you got for us?
Yeah, so this is a list coming from Visitor636. It is a Mardu Smallpox list, and it features a card that is near and dear to my heart, Nether Spirit, this mysterious one black for a 2/2 spirit. With at the beginning of your upkeep, if it's the only creature in your graveyard, the loneliest creature in your graveyard, it comes back to life. And this card was straight out of Mercadian Masks, I believe, and has been a very interesting, grindy, control, finisher-type card. And one reason I like it is because in Canlander Pox, Nether Spirit is best friends with Trading Post, which is one of the cards that was nominated, although I'm not sure if it's in that top margin. But you can use it to every turn sack a creature to bring back an artifact. In this list, it's just used as a value creature, and the rest of the deck is just this sort of Mardu, you know, 4 Smallpox, 4 Smiting Helix, couple Lingering Souls. We're the only, you know, small discard package of 1 Thoughtseize, 3 Inquisition of Kozilek, but then 3 Liliana of the Veil, 4 Nahiri the Harbinger, and 4 Cleansing Wildfire are kind of like the standouts. And so it just, these decks are always kind of tier 2-ish decks. I'm not even sure they're exactly tier 2. But people love them. I have become a fan over the last 6 months, I'd say. And they have always, you know, new excuses to try out the deck in a league again. And in this case, it's Cleansing Wildfire, which can always ramp the deck. The deck is already happy playing 4 Flagstones of Trocare because they're good with Smallpox.
Yeah, I don't think I've actually seen a Mardu or a red Smallpox deck before. when I hear Pox, I'm like, oh yeah, you want black white for Flagstones and probably Lingering Souls, just because those play so nicely with the attrition game of Liliana and discarding and that sort of thing. I'm kind of surprised this list goes so high on the curve to go up all the way to Nahiri the Harbinger.
Yeah, I mean, I think you want something to play on four because you do still have that natural curve of like one drop, you know, whatever, Thoughtseize on two, you kill your own Flagstones to ramp. Sort of like the red-white land destruction deck we were playing, but instead of playing dedicated land destruction, you're trying to just grind them out with smallpox at the end of all that.
Yeah, it's the 2-4 skip. And don't worry, if you draw too many Nahiris, you can always discard them to smallpox or Liliana or Seasoned Pyromancer or other Nahiri.
Yeah, there's even the full set of Smiting Helix, a card that I love, but it's so slow. But yeah, I guess that, like you said, so many discard outlets. So it's nice to see these cards come together, at least for one league.
Yeah, there was also a cool Mardu list played by Ilsic Nasty that was not a smallpox list, but did take advantage of a lot of these similar synergies. I guess I'm surprised they're not playing more Fetid Heath. You want that black-black, and so Fetid Heath does an awesome job turning the white mana from Flagstones into black-black. I guess you have two Urborgs as well.
Part of the trouble with Fetid Heath is that neither of those mana help you with Seasoned Pyromancer, so it's kind of awkward. Mm. I guess the colorless does, if you just tap it for colorless.
Yeah, I mean, this deck just has pips all over the place, though. So they're trying to play four Flagstones of Trollcarrer. That's just a white. And then Smallpox is black-black. Seasoned Pyromancer has two red pips. Yeah, I mean, maybe they did the best job that they could. They're obviously, I think, being able to fetch up that Triome whenever you need it is very handy.
Yeah, and the filter lands really are quite good for these sorts of situations. Yeah, obviously, you introduce a little bit more variance, but nothing timely topics can't solve.
Damon, what do you think this Nether Spirit was doing exactly? Obviously, it's not blocking Blastoderms anymore, like back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Why? What do they accomplish in today's modern? You know, it trades with a Field of the Zombie. Most decks could just get spew these out endlessly for free with Field of the Dead in the late game. There's no super great synergy. There's no Trading Post, for example, here.
I guess if you felt like you were expecting a lot of Scourge of the Skyclaves, Death Shadow, and Prowess type decks, you know, we should mention that the M. Hayashi style Obosh Red has just been tearing it up. The MTGO player Tweedle won both challenges this weekend on M. Hayashi's Obosh Red deck, and M. Hayashi is still by far in a way the trophy leader in Modern with this strategy. So in that sense, I mean, a Nether Spirit, even if you just discard off a smallpox, can cover a lot of bases there. So who knows?
I guess that makes Smiting Helix more attractive too, because it's so sweet to just go just face your opponent and put yourself over 20 to kill Skyclave. Like that, you just win all those games, which just feels so sweet.
All right, so that deck is super sweet from Visitor 636. David, what is your pick of the week?
My pick of the week is an actual factual brew in Pioneer by a Johnny 89. They even snuck. Oh, no, there is no Johnny in here. I thought they snuck a Johnny into this deck, but they failed our cat friend. This is a white-green tokens deck. So it's taking advantage of four Raise the Alarm, four Sapperling Migration. It has Anointed Procession to double token effects. That's a card that's near and dear to Dan's heart. It has three Conclave Tribunal, so that's going to very commonly just be one white exile, any permanent. It has a bunch of other token generators, including two Gideon and four Nissa. And then in the creature slot, it has four Voice of Resurgence, which can be a token maker. Brimaz, which gets to make tokens if it attacks. And two Trostani Discordant. 22 lands, one of which is a Westvale Abbey. And yeah, I am just stunned that a deck like this did so well. 5-0, awesome result for a Giant 89. It kind of flies in the face of what we think about when we talk about like what are the powerful cards in Pioneer to base our strategies around. This is a green deck that does not play any mana elves. It only has three pieces of removal in its main deck, which is just three Conclave Tribunal. It plays Planeswalkers that we don't typically see, including a six mana Elspeth Sun's Champion in a 22 land deck, and one Huatli Radiant Champion, which you just don't see anywhere. Yeah, really interesting choices. I'd be really interested in watching these games. I'm just trying to like picture how the games play out. And, you know, these are cards, some of them, you know, people like, some of them people don't. But we don't commonly see any of these cards in decks that 5-0 in Pioneer.
Yeah, this is not your typical Pioneer deck. It does seem like you could use some Mana Elves. I mean, there's only three Legion's Landing as one drops. And the old, you know, Llanowar Elf into Nissa, Voice of Zendikar is, I don't know if it's like the most powerful start in Pioneer, but it is, it's something.
How slow is this deck?
It seems exceedingly slow to me. Like Damon says, you got to be way under 50% to have a play on turn one. Your play on turn two is to make 2 1/1s. And then your play on turn three is to like make a Planeswalker and make an 0/1.
Yeah, and the thing with Planeswalkers is that if you fall behind early, then the Planeswalkers just die to your opponent's creatures.
And then the payoff for making all these tokens, I'm like waiting for Venerated Loxodon or something, but there aren't any.
Yeah, exactly. Like in my thought process, like, okay, they have Conclave Tribunal and 4 Venerated Loxodon to kind of, you know, get your cheap effect from your 8, you know, make 2 1/1s. There are none. There's only 3 Legion's Landing, so even flipping that on turn 3 is exceedingly rare. You know, there's Anointed Procession, so that's a card that says you're planning on taking a lot of turns.
Yeah, it's kind of the opposite as Venerated Loxodon. This one wants to come down before you make the tokens.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm just surprised that they had time to do all this. You know, they want to play Anointed Procession on turn 4. They have no ramp, as we talked about. And then every turn after that, they're going to get extra value from it. So yeah, I'm just really impressed. Very impressive result. Like I said, I'd be interested to know what their matchup spread is like.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, in terms of token payoffs, I mean, Nissa, Voice of Zendikar, and Gideon, Ally of Zendikar, these Zendikar besties, both can come in and anthem your team in the form of Gideon's Emblem or Nissa's +1/+1 counter down tick. And, I mean, 2 Trisani Discordant, so maybe they just felt like they already had enough ways to pump their squad.
Those also help make Anointed Procession slightly less bad. If the turn you cast Procession, you don't get anything from it, you're really having a slow turn. But if you already have a free token maker or a 0 mana token maker on the board, Nissa can do that, Gideon can do that. There's even the Brimaz, King of Oreskos. So these are all cards that if they're already in play and then you play the Anointed Procession, you get some benefit.
Yeah, Anointed Procession basically turns Nissa into Tevesh Zat, Doom of Fools. Sort of.
Exactly.
You're speaking a whole different language, Damon. That the commander bug is taking hold of your mind.
So yeah, like I don't know if they stole a bunch of games with Westfall Abbey. I don't know if they were, you know, getting their squad up and then, you know, like Damon's talking about antheming them and getting them in. I don't know if they were playing Anointed Procession, you know, on 4 and then just grinding out other mid-range decks. Like we said, those are kind of few and far between.
It's pretty often I'm playing a Pioneer deck and realize like you just literally can't beat a flipped Westvale Abbey.
Yeah, like I'm wondering, did they consider playing, for instance, the 4 mana enchantment and every time you play a land, you get a 2/2 or you get to put +1/+1 counters on your creatures? That seems more powerful to me than some of these other cards, but maybe it's a card they considered and then decided not to play.
The thing with Feldar Retreat in a deck like this is there just aren't enough lands and there aren't any fetch lands. And I play the card in a green-white Canlander deck as my point of reference there. And you have Knight of the Reliquary, tons of fetches, Ramnap Excavator, a billion ways to kind of just dump a bunch of lands into play in a hurry. And the card just goes nuts in that deck. It's so much fun. In this deck, you'd play it on turn 4, and then if you don't even have a land drop the next turn, it's really bad.
Just for a brief point of comparison, I noticed a similar green-white tokens deck that had 5-0 this week, but in Modern. And if we look at that list by Crazy Clicker, it had a lot of the same cards, so Raise the Alarm, Nissa, Voice of Zendikar, Legion's Landing, Conclave Tribunal. But then instead of like the slower stuff that we've been talking about, it looks like this modern build had a lot of more explosive token generation. There's Spectral Procession can make 3 tokens for Lingering Souls with a light black splash to enable the flashback, so you're getting, you know, 4 tokens out of one card there. Saprolite Migration is actually still here. I'm kind of surprised that that makes the cut in Modern, but I guess if you've decided that the thing you want to do is just make 2 tokens for 2 mana, I mean, that this is a way to do it. But the speed question, I mean, there's the full playset of Intangible Virtue here, the 4 Venerated Loxodon, so you have more ways to get big. And then just to get on the board faster, perhaps there's Kithion, Hero of Akros, which is like a 1 mana Planeswalker if you're going to flip it pretty reliably, which I think this deck will.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, just having more one drops just seems so necessary to me. So, I mean, this deck has 6 instead of 3. That's a huge change. And Kithion is legal, I might add, in Pioneer. You can.
Yeah, a lot of these cards are legal in Pioneer, so it's kind of interesting to see the divergent choices there.
Yeah, Kithion's a weird one in the sense that it gives your opponent a pretty good outlet for their fatal pushes or whatever that the deck otherwise might not have. And the as much as I've flipped Gideon Battleforged into play, it doesn't do that much.
I mean, it's a 4/4. for one.
Yeah, it's a one mana 4/4. What the hell?
Exactly.
I will still say that by the time you flip it, the impact of that card is not always as large as you would think.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, however they did it, congratulations to Ajani89 on the great finish. It'd be interesting, you know, it's a copycat world, so it'll be interesting to see if lists like this show up in future deck dumps. If they don't, and we know lots of people like to play these types of lists, that's kind of a sign that either Ajani89 just played very well, or maybe they were very fortunate.
Already casting doubts, David.
No, I'm just saying, we have a testable hypothesis here. We know that people are going to copy this list and play it. If it keeps showing up in the 5-0s, then we know that there's something here that I am not recognizing as a very powerful interaction.
Yeah. So next up, we have Dan's pick of the week.
Yeah, I'm sticking with Pioneer as well. My pick of the week is Big Red by Gotalicious. This deck took first place in the Sunday Pioneer Challenge. There was a similar build by Runeskjold that actually took top 32, top 16 maybe, in the Saturday Challenge. I have not really seen this deck before in Pioneer. I'm not totally sure where it came from or who was the originator of this archetype. When I hear the words Big Red, I'm thinking of like a deck from, I don't know, 8-10 years ago or something, where, much like our discussion of Lightning Bolt, you know, you are allowed to use these red spells defensively and just sort of keep yourself from dying if you have a grip full of Lightning Bolts, or in this case, Bone Crusher Giants, red sweepers. Here there's four Anger of the Gods. And then just eventually win with threats that start on 4, 5, 6 mana or more. In that sense, this shell is working in a similar space. All it's really looking to do is hit land drops early and defend itself with those red removal spells. The top end payoffs are a full set of Chandra, Torch of Defiance, 4 Thoughtknot Seers, and then jumping up the curve from 4 to 8, we have a full playset of Ugin the Spirit Dragon. Yeah, that Ugin from Tron. So how are you making that jump? Well, this deck actually plays Ironcrag Feat and Vessel of Volatility to make a big jump in mana. And some of the other slots to just sort of round out the deck and give you something to do also lean into the mana acceleration concept as well. So the Cleansing Wildfire is here as a 4-of, and we're looking to target our own lands, the Cascading Cataracts and the Darksteel Citadel. This is a package that I think David had been interested in during our Cleansing Wildfire week. Although, I think, David, when you were playing the Pioneer version of the deck, you were imagining Karn the Great Creator as sort of one of your big payoffs to be both a source of card advantage and something to do with all your mana. This deck does not play Karn.
Yeah, and it's funny. I was actually watching some of the historic decks and jealous because they get to play like normal 2-mana accelerators. They get to play Mind Stone and whatever, the one that can become a creature. So I was like, man, it'd be so sweet to be able to play those in Pioneer, although obviously maybe the format would be different. But yeah, I hated Karn. Karn's actually very bad in Pioneer. And so I was thinking to myself, is there another way to play Ugin? And this player, Gotalicious, found a way to do that. So yeah, I'd been kind of like sketching this out in my brain. I think they just like solved a puzzle I was only starting to tinker with. One of the things that's interesting is the deck is built very similarly to that like Minotaur list. It was trying to turbo out like an Ironcrag Feat into the 8 mana, put like 4 Minotaurs into play. So this deck just eschews like all those terrible Minotaurs and just plays Planeswalkers, which we know Wizards has made super powerful. So their like fair plan is just like really good. And Chandra, Torch of Defiance as like card advantage engine slash eventual win against control, and then also a ramp piece into your other cards is just like very clever. So getting rid of Karn, which is just not good, and replacing it with good cards turns out to be a winning strategy.
Yeah, and you even have a 4 Cleansing Wildfire to not only give you the boost off your own lands, but also mess up Oops All Spells decks at least a little bit. Mm. Maybe long enough to steal game one, maybe not. Meanwhile, Valakut Awakening means that the late game Ironcrag Feat and Vessel of Volatilities can be turned into better cards. And without Karn, you have a full sideboard. You know, you have room for 4 Soulguide Lanterns, a bunch of Damping Spheres, Ratchet Bombs, an extra Chandra Awakened Inferno, which is, you know, my favorite big red finisher, following in the footsteps of Arcslogger and Inferno Titan.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that at this point, I believe Oops All Spells, or as I like to call it, Oops, I Don't Like to Play Magic, is the best deck in Pioneer. So like Damon says, I think Cleansing Wildfire is actually great against them, and giving you someone on a game one and then making your game two match with 4 Soulguide Lantern plus 4 Cleansing Wildfire is really important. So you know, in high level play, you're going to play Oops All Spells two or three times in your six matches, and they probably have a very good matchup against them. So I think that's very, very well designed.
Yeah, super cool deck. I just love most of the cards in here just as cards, and I kind of given up on some of them, and I'm just happy to see them succeeding. I mean, we love Maze Mind Tome. That's here as a four of. I think we've loved the idea that a mid-range style deck should play somewhere between three and five of the double face cards, and you know, whether that's Glasspool Mimic or Spikefield Hazard. And it's interesting to see here that they've eschewed the Spikefield Hazard. They feel like that's not as useful as the Valakut Awakening. And that's probably just true, given the state of the Pioneer metagame right now. There's even Golo's Tireless Pilgrim, which is not just a ramp spell, but if it fetches Cascading Cataracts, that gives you access to all five colors, so it can actually activate its free cast ability. There was a one of in the Sunday winning list, and the Saturday list that took top 32 had three Golos as well. So it looks like there's still a room to tinker around and figure out what is the best use of these slots. But nice proof of concept from these two results here.
I do think with mono green planeswalkers being resuscitated by Aspiring Spike, the ability to kill that on turn one mana elf is not zero anymore. Mono black is gone. That was another card that that effect was better against. But I'd probably stick one in there. I'd find a way to sneak one in there instead of the full four Valakut Awakenings, I think.
I don't know. Is Valakut Awakening like one of the best MDFCs? I feel like it's seeing more play than almost any other one right now.
Hmm.
You know, like the Timu's been continuing to make top eights in the challenges with his blue-red Kiki Crackling Drake Valakut Awakening deck.
Well, I think Valakut Awakening is a good card, but I think you have to adjust to what the metagame is kind of doing. And if there's going to be multiple mono-green planeswalkers, I'd rather be able to have an out to kill their turn one elf as opposed to never being able to do it. But maybe Four Angers is just good enough. I mean, if Four Angers is just getting the job done and they're just like, all right, I've already got that locked down, like go ahead and ramp into your whatever, I'm just going to sweep it.
Yeah, I mean, also, if you ever have, if you ever resolve Ugin against the mono green list,
yeah,
they have so few outs to that.
True.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of the gamble here. I think of Pioneer as extremely control heavy right now, but Ugin might just be able to go over the top of most of the other control decks just because it's a unique threat. You know, it sweeps away all the Uros and Planeswalkers and Omnaths and whatever else. So if that's the case, then this list could actually be a nice just sort of like sledgehammer to the rock, paper, scissors of control combo burn of Pioneer right now.
Well, what's interesting too is that there's not many shuffle effects in the deck, and so you have a lot of cards that are bad against control, but you can steadily Valakut Awaken them to the bottom of your deck. And then you have a bunch of cards that are pretty good against control in the form of the Bone Crushers, Thought Aseers, Chandras, Ugin's Big Chandra, which is uncounterable, Maze Mind Tome.
Yeah, I mean, I think the sort of classic control this deck would be very good against. The one list I'd be worried about is the Jeskai Luka, where they're probably going to be able to start taking your lands, and your removal of Anger of the Gods is not actually good against the 0-4 wall that their enchantment makes, or an end of turn Shark Typhoon token. But that's only one deck. It's probably like 4 or 5% of the format.
Yeah, super interesting archetype. Congrats to Godalicious and Runeskjold on the great results. So those are our picks of the week. We will take a short break. When we come back, we will have our testing results from last week, plus a new card to brew around. Stick with us.
All right, we are back. So last week, we didn't really have a card. We ran down all the options for the community brewing target. So this week, we were just sort of left on our own devices. And I had been wanting to explore this card, Astral Drift, which is from Modern Horizons. It got a lot of interest when it was first spoiled because Astral Drift is so close to Astral Slide. And for old-timey players like myself, Astral Slide was a dominant standard card. And so the thought was this slightly better version of it maybe could be played in Modern. So the Astral Drift, just as a reminder, is 2 and a white for an enchantment. And it reads, whenever you cycle Astral Drift or cycle another card while Astral Drift is on the battlefield, you may exile target creature. If you do, return that card to the battlefield under its owner's control at the beginning of the next end step. So sort of a Flicker Wisp-like ability, but it can only target creatures, creatures you control or creatures your opponents control. And then it can cycle, so that's where it's sort of strictly better than Astral Slide. 2 and a white, you can cycle Astral Drift and blink a creature. So My thought was that we have all these free cyclers now in Modern. We have Street Wraith, we have Edge of Autumn, if you want to get really ambitious, and we have all the cycling lands are now available, and you have Ren and Six to buy them back constantly. So I wanted to explore a list that was blinking all these creatures, and then before you had to play all these instant sorceries, and we want to have a deck that's dense full of creatures. But we have Skyclave Apparition, which is one of the best, if not the best card in the most recent set. It's kind of a catch-all. All of a sudden, your deck that normally is all these like crappy walls and stuff you're blinking can exile Jace, can get rid of Teferi. It can get rid of Skyclave, whatever. It can get rid of Death Shadow. It's okay against the Prowess creatures. I wasn't sure if the deck could really close, so I put 4 Yadaro in the list, thinking that, you know, we're cycling so much, we'll see Yadaro a bunch of times, and it won't be that long before we all of a sudden have this 8-8 Trample Haster in play, and that will hopefully end the game as we've sort of slowed the game down with our Astral Drift. My first version even had a Field of the Dead in it, thinking, you know, we got Ren and Six buying lands back, we got Life from the Loam, we have Renegade Rallier, which is most of the time going to just put a land into play. Eventually, we'll just sort of get up to 7 lands once we've kind of slowed the game down, and that's just sort of an alternative win condition. So I ran this through a league, and I think I went 1-4, and the games are all really interesting, but what I found is that Astral Drift is a super tempo-negative play. It's a 3-mana enchantment that doesn't do anything. You have to have a 2-mana creature in play. We only have 3 of them, and a free cycler to do anything the turn it comes into play. I found myself wanting more cheap cyclers, because every time Astral Drift is in play, you just want to like cycle as many times as possible, get a bunch of value. The fact that the cards come back at end of turn is kind of frustrating. So, and Yadaro was just so slow. I mean, the card is sweet. I really want it to be good. It's definitely like a pet card for me. But the one time I even got it in play, you know, by that time, Prowess was like, fine, you know, you did block my Lurrus, but I've accrued enough value that I'm just going to burn you out. Which they did. So I updated the deck a little bit. I went to the full 4 Edge of Autumns. I went to the full, I cut all 4 Yadaros. I added a 3rd Thragtusk. I wanted to play a Blood Moon just because I think you need to find ways to steal games without playing Magic against some of these other decks. I added a couple paths just so I had a card I could flashback over and over again with Ren and Six were I to ultimate it. So I took that through a league, and that actually went okay. I went 3-2. I beat this Esper Arayo deck that everyone is so hot about. It was pretty easy, honestly. Lost a really close one to Green-White Titan, beat Red-Black Prowess, and then lost to Jund Shadow and Urien Bant. I beat Jund Shadow. I got the wrong record down here. I went 3-2. So the problem is that I kept coming back to is you have to bend your whole deck to play this Astral Drift sort of package. And it just isn't that good. Astral Drift can be exiled by Skyclave Apparition, which is super common deck or card in Modern. The turn you play Astral Drift, if you don't have anything in play, if you're just playing that in passing, you know, if they play 3-mana Teferi and bounce it, I mean, you basically just can't win that game. And then once you're sort of ahead, it takes you a really long time to win. You have to like blink Thragtusk over and over again. So the deck was just super clunky. You know, for those of us who are of a certain age, it brought back some good times of blinking cards over and over again. But yeah, ultimately, I felt like it was kind of a limited strategy.
Yeah, I suppose your top end here is to flicker a Thragtusk over and over again from cycling stuff, whereas Aspiring Spikes Ban Ephemerate deck's top end is to loop Eternal Witness and Time Warp to take infinite turns, which somehow seems a little bit better. And so I guess the question is the in-between, now not the top end, where you would come out ahead of that sort of strategy?
I can see why the deck is built this way. I think that if you're thinking through, okay, I want to start with Astral Drift, that's my key card. What are the best cyclers? Street Wraith, Edge of Autumn, those are the free ones. The next best cyclers, oh, there's the Tranquil Thicket, Secluded Step from Modern Horizons, and then some way to rebuy them, you know, Ren and Six, Life from the Loam. You know, it seems like one thing just follows after the other. Now I've got my cyclers, I've got my engine card, now I need something to blink for value to like make sure I actually win. So that's my Thragtusk, my Renegade Valiers. Now I need something to defend myself, so maybe the Skyclave can do that. It all makes sense, but at the same time, it's kind of like an A plus B plus C plus D. And it's not even a combo, really. It's just like you need all these things to be firing, and they don't add up to anything super scary from the opponent's side. I should add that I was inspired by sort of the eye concept, so I took this list out for a spin myself. I changed maybe like 1 or 2 cards. But I found that I was just like struggling. I went 2-3, but the wins were not because of Astral Drift. So basically, I won a match against Storm with just like hate cards and a match against Burn with Thragtusk. I guess I should take that back. Astral Drift protected my Eidolon of Rhetoric or something from removal, but apart from that, like, it wasn't anything else that the deck was doing that was winning that match. And then when it came time to, like, defend myself from, like, Omnath, Saheeli Copycat or something, or, you know, Ponza, Blood Moon, that kind of stuff, I just couldn't quite do it. I couldn't get the engine up and running. I was, like, really intrigued, but still mostly just confused by what is the strength of an Astral Drift deck.
Well, in theory, Astral Drift should allow you to dominate the mid-game. The problem is that it doesn't, and there is no mid-game to be played in Modern. So those two things coincide to doom you. The problem is you're working really hard to do a thing that, like, Earl's just naturally doing. So, I mean, there's basically, like, four major threats in Modern, and if you're not playing those, you should play an infinite combo. We don't have an infinite combo. We aren't playing Uro. We aren't playing Prowess Creatures. We aren't playing Primetime. And we aren't playing Aether Vial. And so there's really the only powerful card we're really playing is Skye Clave Apparition. And we do get to blink it a lot. So every time I sort of had that going, but there are decks that don't care about that. One of them is any deck that's playing Primeval Titan. You have a really hard time interacting with that. Dan, your list doesn't play Path, so you basically can't ever kill it. All you can do is keep blinking it over and over again.
Yeah, so the defensive use of Astral Drift was another thing that I wasn't sure whether I should expect anything from it. Unlike Ephemerae, Astral Drift can be used on your opponent's creatures if you need to, you know, break up something. I used it defensively against, like, Goblin Electromancer and Baral a couple times, but I also found myself, like, needing to blink Felidar Guardians and Omnaths, and that felt super bad. Like, I need to defend myself, but I don't want to blink their Seasoned Pyromancer. That feels real bad. Or their Stoneforge Mystic. So I just, like, had a hard time getting that side of the card to work for me. And then on the flip side, like, I, even with these cyclers like Street Wraith and Edge of Autumn reducing the deck size, there aren't that many copies of each of the necessary components. Like, there just aren't that many slots left in the deck for, like, creatures that we can blink for value.
Yeah, I mean, you just have to dedicate so much of the deck to make it work, and Ephemerate basically does exactly the same thing, because I only got about, like, two uses out of a given Astral Drift. So Ephemerate does that for one mana, and you can have a bunch of normal cards in your deck, and for Astral Drift you have to pay three mana, and then wait a turn, and you have to play a bunch of not normal cards in your deck, and have an atrocious mana base somehow, even though you're playing, like, 28 lands.
Now, if you think you're going to be playing against the Green-White Tokens deck all day, then I'm sure Astral Drift is a premier card.
Yeah, one would hope, but, like, it's... I was facing down a bunch of Seasoned Pyromancer tokens, and I couldn't kill them all. Like, there just aren't that many ways to trigger the drift. And I know that sounds weird, because we just named a bunch of cyclers, but the total density of cycling cards is a lot smaller than what you might think of if you're thinking of, oh, cycling, like, Flourishing Fox, Zenith Flare-type decks from, like, the Lurrus Companion era. That was a good deck in Standard and Pioneer, but, you know, that deck was, like, 40 cycling cards or something. This is only 16 cycling cards. 20 if you count the drift. Yes, you could rebuy them, but it's just not that many cyclers.
What were the payoffs to Flicker in the Astral slide days?
Well, you played... they had a red enchantment that let you shock whenever you cycled, so you didn't really worry about blinking your own creatures. You had a couple of cards that just got lands back into your hand, so those have basically been replaced by Ren and Six. So you just blink this card over and over again, or E-Witness, you'd get back your lands, you'd cycle again, and then you'd set up a loop where you would, like, shock and blink, you know, block. This is also when damage got put on the stack, right. So your E-Witness got to do 2 damage to whatever was attacking, blink back, get your land, and then you'd shock with your, I think it was Rhystic something, Dan? Rhystic Study?
Lightning Rift, I believe.
Lightning Rift, yeah. Also, you know, they just didn't make, like, one mana 6 power creatures back then, so you had a lot more time.
Yeah, you could defend yourself from opposing a Chroma Angel of Wrath by blinking it out with the Astral Drift, or Astral Slide, I should say.
So anyway, it was fun. It was cool. I'm glad I, like, tooled around with it, but I basically determined that I don't think there's, like, a future for this card. I'm not saying I built it perfectly, but just the generic interactions of it are not that powerful, so.
Yeah, I have to concur that I feel like this shell, it doesn't quite have the secret sauce. As far as we know, Astral Drift has only succeeded once in Modern, that in that 5-0 list that you picked out as your pick of the week 2 weeks ago, David. And that was a weird list too, so I'm just not really sure what to make of this card.
Yeah, I mean, that list was definitely trying to cheese out games with Blood Moon, so maybe they just did that a bunch, which is, like, a very reasonable thing to do in Modern.
Now, Ephemerate, on the other hand, has been doing great ever since it was printed, and we're seeing kind of another resurgence of blink strategies. So what do you guys make of this sort of new blink?
Aspiring Spike's Ephemerate control deck is such a well-built deck in the way that it handles gameplay. I mean, to some extent, it just has like a really good package to let Uro take over and just fend things off with Skyclave Apparition for a while. But meanwhile, you can always go over the top of infinite Field of the Dead, or not infinite Field of the Dead tokens, finite Field of the Dead tokens with infinite turns. And it has Cryptic Commands to stop the kind of combo decks that would go around Skyclave Apparition. And so it has a really good balance of kind of ground game to play creatures and interaction early turns that affect the board, along with late game grind with the Uros or just the Ephemerate Eternal Witness.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I like is, you know, and he and I had talked about it when he was on the pod, is neither of us thought Soul Herder was that good. The card that was really good was actually Ephemerate. And I think that was like the real, when the light went on for Gabriel Nassif, when he was the first one to sort of popularize this, he almost made it as a meme. And again, we have this joke where it becomes a deck that is a force to be reckoned with. And so he was like, what if I just like cut all the cards I was playing just to make Soul Herder good? And that let him really reduce his number of creatures. It lets him play a really slim package to take infinite turns. He's not all in on it, like Damon's referring to. And then he gets to play all these other spells. He still gets the possibility to Mystic Sanctuary lock. And then he's a little bit more in on Uro as just like this really powerful threat that he gets to play. So yeah, I really like the look of this list. I think one of the things that was really important is playing two Mystic Gates. Damon pointed out earlier, these filter lands are really powerful, and this helps you cast your Skyclave Apparition and your Uro Titan of Nature's Wrath. One of the reasons people hadn't been adding as much white is because you're so locked in on needing your blue-green for your Icefang Quaddle. You want to be able to fetch a bunch of basics so your Icefang Quaddle can sort of function as a removal spell. Now, it's not as important that it be a removal spell because you get these four Skyclave Apparitions. Like we said, one of the better cards in Modern. And then Mystic Gate helps you cast that and your Uro with the same kind of lands in play because you are going to want to play at basic planes.
Yeah, the Icefangs here are really subtly interesting and powerful. There's a bunch of cards that can cantrip for two mana. There's Wall of Omens, Wall of Blossoms. Omens is here as a 3-of, Blossoms is not. Coiling Oracle, if you just want to blink something, Coiling Oracle has the highest upside, we could say, because, you know, flipping a land is awesome, putting it directly into play. But here it's like, you're not going to get the Death Touch early, but you will eventually get it, and you really want that flash aspect. You're playing Remands and Cryptics, Force of Negations, Ephemerates, Paths, so there's a lot of stuff that you can represent if your creatures allow you to pass with mana open.
Yeah, even the one of Venser. And the walls, I think, are important because when you have Skyclave Apparition, you end up giving your, and Ephemerate, you end up giving your opponent lots of like 1/1s and 2/2s. And so Wall of Omen just blanks those cards. They aren't pressuring you like they normally would. So it gives you a lot of time to kind of set up your soft lock on the, or hard lock on the game.
Yeah. Honestly, I think Ephemerate is a slightly broken Magic card. It just hasn't quite become broken enough like Arkham's Astrolabe to really warp a format around it. But it's so good.
Yeah, for sure. So this Bant blink that Aspiring Spike just sort of unveiled, he immediately took second place back-to-back weeks in Modern Challenges. And I mean, the deck looks amazing. I don't know if because of this result, but I've seen other blink decks popping up again in the challenge this past weekend. There was, I would just call it like a Urien blink that is also an Omnath Soul Herder taking turns mashup. Like at a certain point, if you're just looking for things to blink and doing it with Ephemerate, you arrive at the card Omnath Locus of Creation and you're like, yeah, why not? You know, it's like that meme with the Bilbo Baggins looking at the Ring of Power and he's like, why shouldn't I play Omnath? Why not? And you're like, okay, sure, get a Soul Herder in there too. I mean, this deck looks like a monstrosity, but I mean, most of these cards are good. Most, not Stonehorn Dignitary.
And these lists are not even set in stone. I've seen the Uro Omnath list that also has Urien play the cat combo in it instead of some of these other cards. And, you know, so that gives you Oath of Nissa as another cool blink target, both for your cat or for your Urien. I like the look of that one maybe a little better because I think the card quality is a little higher. I don't think you need to go like super deep into Stonehorn Dignitary Thassa, Deep Dwelling. I'm not sure these are cards that we need to concern ourselves with.
I mean, I think Stormheart Dignitary wins against a decent chunk of Modern. I mean, any sort of like humans or prowess or red-black shadow type list will have a lot of trouble against this card, much less even the Amulet Titan list if you can keep them off the Valakut plan. Zombies aren't very good against Stormheart Dignitary plus Soul Herder.
On the one hand, this has the Aether Vial Illidamri's Call package that I think we really like that. On the other hand, this is a 95 card Urion deck with Aether Vials, so will you have the vial? I'm not sure, but if you do, I could see how, you know, yeah, putting these bullets like Stonehorn, Venser, and Thassa, Deputy of Detention, even can get you out of some tight spots.
Yeah, they're also like 4 Time Warp, 4 Eternal Witness, so they're not just in on a Stonehorn Dignitary lock, they're also in on the infinite Time Warp draws. I mean, I'm just not a, like, Urion fan when you play a bunch of cards that, like, bifurcate how your games go. I've talked about this before, so I apologize for my pedantic nature, but 4 Aether Vial is awesome in this list like this, and then you just draw it way less. So I think Spike understood. He said that one of the keys was to just cut Aether Vial from his list, and he's not even playing it in a 60-card list, and I think that is the strength of it.
Yeah. On the other hand, I mean, this deck plays a lot of one-ofs, and Urion really helps you do that. In a guiltless way, or slightly less guilty way.
Yeah, you just make the one choice to play Urion. That's your only decision you have to feel guilty about. And then every other decision after that, you don't have to feel guilty about. It's like, well, I got 80 cards. I got to fill it out somehow.
Exactly.
Okay, so what have we learned from our little sidebar foray into the world of blinking? Astral Drift, I think we're just going to set that aside, basically.
I think Astral Drift would be more attractive if Ephemerate didn't exist, but Ephemerate does exist, and as Damon says, it's either super powerful or possibly broken or actually broken. I mean, it's on the border, so that maybe needs to be on the list of cards that are sort of on that, like, Uro, you know, prime time. It's almost a card that justifies the existence of a deck archetype because of how powerful it is. And it works very well with Skyclave Apparition. So the same color, it doesn't ask for you to do extra. And then all of a sudden, Skyclave Apparition just gives you outs to generic types of permanents. You don't have to, you know, before you have one Night of Autumn or whatever, it's like Apparition does all that for you. You don't have to think about it. It gets any permanent at all, Planeswalkers, etc. I actually kind of dislike how generic it is. It just reduces the text box of everything else to basically nothing. It'd be nice if it could get all kinds of permanents except for one, just so there was some decision-making process, but it doesn't. And so, yeah, it's just a super powerful card.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Ephemerate, Damon thinks, is one of the most broken cards that we haven't quite realized how broken it is. And I can see that. I mean, Cloud Shift was already underappreciated, and this is 2 of them for the same price.
Oh, just wait till you hear what I think about the card Tithe for 1 white mana, white instance.
That's not Modern Legal, is it?
No, sadly. It's like the white Ancestral Recall.
What is this, from Visions or something? Get a Plains, yeah, or yeah. Get 2 Plains?
But you can get like cards like Irrigated Farmland, for example. and so it actually, like, getting a 2-for-1 for a single white mana is insane. Like, that's just not what cards do in Magic. And Ephemerate does that. And that's kind of why I consider it, like, broken.
And it sets up the soft loop with Eternal Witness, where it basically is, like, a Howling Mind for you for the rest of the game. But the Howling Mind is always drawing an action spell.
Yeah, Tithe isn't quite that good. But Tithe is really good in other applications.
Yes.
How do you feel about Thraben Inspector? That's a 2-for-1 for a single white mana.
if a 1-2 is worth a card, it's good.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that that's pretty much all there is to say about these cards. Shall we take a short break and come back with our card of the week?
Yeah. See you on the other side. Welcome back. Our card for this week is Seagate Stormcaller, the rudest card in the town. You know, everyone's trying to have a nice sunny day and they call in the storms to mess up the ships. But it's 1 and a blue for a 2/1 human wizard with kicker 4 and a blue on ETB. Copy the next instant or sorcery spell that you play with CMC 2 or less. And then if you kicked it, you get a copy of the spell twice, and you can choose new targets for the copies. This is a kind of a strange card mechanically. You don't see this type of template very often. This creates a delayed trigger. And because you're going to be doing this casting this at sorcery speed, you don't really benefit from getting instant speed copies. And sorceries are generally more powerful. That may be where you start looking. Counterspells in particular really don't do much with this card. The copies have to have CMC 2 or less, which is a very explicit thing. So, for example, Wizard's Lightning, even though it kind of feels like it costs one mana, even with a wizard out, like the Seagate Stormcaller itself, will not get copied. And it's why this card is quite busted in Vintage Cube with Time Walk, but does not have Time Walk available, only has Time Warp in Modern, making it not quite as good. When you copy the spell, you don't have to worry about, you know, Kicker or Escalation or things like that. So Collective Brutality just has that copied for free. And in the late game, I've actually never seen it happen, but in theory, you can kick it. So for five blue, you play it, you get 2/1, and you get your next spell essentially cast in, three times.
I've done that once. Copied a lightning bolt, then I died.
9 damage richer, though.
I wanted to tell that story to my grandkids, but then I died. So I have to read about it. So the immediate comparison, of course, is Snapcaster Mage. You see this card, you see the mana cost, the power toughness, even the creature types, and you're like, oh, this is the new Snapcaster. Obviously, things like that typically mean worse than Snapcaster, but that raises other questions, like maybe it's still good enough that you could play it alongside Snapcaster in Modern, or maybe it's good enough, a close enough facsimile to Snapcaster that, you know, we should look at it more closely in Pioneer or something. So let's just start off with the first basic question, like, how does this stack up head-to-head against Snapcaster? Would you ever play this instead of Snapcaster? It's not exactly the same card, right? So is it ever better than Snapcaster? And then, of course, in what ways is it worse?
Yeah, so the first answer is, well, first off, you know, you can't, you know, snap Cryptic with this card. You can't really do any sort of counter magic stuff with it. So it doesn't slot cleanly in for Snapcaster for a control deck in that sense. On the other hand, it has a few benefits. So the first, it doesn't exile the card. So if that's ever a card you want to cast twice somehow, or Mystic Sanctuary back or whatever, this lets you do it. Secondly, it's just more mana efficient for the cheap plays. So for example, Bolt Snap Bolt costs 4 mana, Stormcaller Bolt costs 3 mana. And then if you go to a 2 CMC play, 2 CMC cards snap, 2 CMC card costs 6 mana total, whereas with Stormcaller it only costs 4. And so that's a meaningful discount in the early game. One problem with Snapcaster is you can't really count it as a 2-drop in your deck for curve considerations. It's more of a 3 or 4-drop, depending on what spells you're typically Snapcastering. And so my favorite interaction here actually is the card Manamorphose, where with Stormcaller, it goes mana neutral, Stormcaller into Manamorphose. You just get all your 4 mana back and draw 2 cards. And so just there's like a free 2/1 into the world, and you get everything else back.
That's so interesting. The mana efficiency of this compared to Snapcaster Mage is not obvious at first, because when you say Bolt Snap Bolt, I'm usually not casting both bolts in the same turn, so I think of that as a 3-mana play. But it's actually, you know, 4 mana because you had to cast both bolts and spend red for both of them. Here you're saying that effectively, if it's turn 3, for example, and I have 3 lands, I can play my Seagate Stormcaller, follow it up with a 1-mana spell, and I've effectively done 3 things that turn. You know, I've cast a Seagate Stormcaller, and I've, with a single mana, then cast 2 Inquisition of Kozilek or something.
And when, you know, you have an effect, you know, we talked about this a little bit when I was getting super excited about Tribal Flames. That's the kind of card that really pays you off to, you know, if you're doing the full 10 for 4 mana, that puts you in a place where you don't need to draw that many actual meaningful spells to win the game.
Yeah, okay, so that's maybe situations where you could see it doing more than Snap. How much worse is it than Snapcaster Mage? It doesn't have flash, right? So we can't even really contemplate it with counter magic. It almost kind of forces you to have a critical mass of stuff that plays at sorcery speed, which is much more constricting than Snapcaster would ever be.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really like Snapcaster. I mean, I don't think those comparisons are relevant. Snapcaster is way, way better. If you want me to pick like a factor, I would say 7.5 times better than this card.
Another way to interpret our estimates of the power levels, this is one of our last cards of Zendikar Rising that we're trying out. I agree with Dave, this card is worse than Snapcaster Mage, but I also totally agree. It's just so different. You slot in Snapcaster to your instant speed control deck. This card really requires you to think about building around it.
Yeah. That's a great point.
Blue Moon would never play this, even if the rates were better, whereas Snapcaster Mage seems like a card that Blue Moon would love to play.
Well, maybe this is the week where I'll slot one Steak and Stone onto Blue Moon and find out for myself.
There we go. Add some Metamorphoses to that list.
I mean, if you somehow line up a Goblin Dark Dwellers on See the Truth with Seagate Stormcaller out.
Oh my god, that sounds insane.
Yeah, even just like the play pattern is going to be so different. Like, if you're in a top deck war and you draw a Snapcaster Mage, you're like, oh great, I drew a Snapcaster. That's kind of like a 2-for-1. I can snap back my opt and advance my game plan. Same situation, you draw a Seagate Stormcaller. It's like, well, if you don't have the second thing in your hand, it just isn't going to do anything. So it's like you just got to hold it for a long time. It's half of a combo piece. It combos with the next spell you cast. Doesn't have to be from your hand. You can flash something back from the graveyard or whatever. But, you know, this is not like a all-in-one, one-stop shop for a 2-for-1 like Snapcaster is. This one, you got to work for it. You got to work real hard.
Yeah, and I think kind of like Scourge of the Skyclaves, that kicker text is almost like flavor text. I know you succeeded at doing it, Dan, but I mean, you basically need to, it has to be good without ever considering that that's going to happen. So.
All right. A couple of other just sort of big picture questions here. We're copying instants and sorceries, CMC 2 or less. What are the best spells that we should be thinking about copying? We've ruled out counter magic, but does that mean we should be looking at what, discard, a burn, lightning bolts, card draw, something else? What do you guys think?
Well, you know, I think I pointed out when this card was spoiled, maybe we want, I am interested in cards that have part of the cost is non-mana. So, you know, we talked about Village Rites. So we get a lot more effect out of one mana than we typically would because part of that cost is sacrificing a creature. Neoform, another card. Cathartic Reunion, another card. Metamorphose, I think Damon explained why that's powerful. You have some really interesting cards listed here, Dad. Shrapnel Blast, Devastating Summons. These are cards where a lot of the cost is built into this sort of requirements to cast, not the mana. And so you're getting a lot more than 2 mana's worth. So when you double that effect, you're moving towards a place where this card is really starting to act like a soft combo, like a homeless man's Splinter Twin, if you will.
What do you think of Devastating Summons while we're on that subject? So that's a single red sorcery, sacrifice any number of lands as the additional cost to cast, and then you get to create 2 tokens. They're XX tokens, where X is the number of lands you sacrificed. This is typically not a 4-of, because it leads to you sacking all of your lands and Armageddoning yourself. But let's say it's turn 3. You play a Seagate Stormcaller, you play Devastating Summons, you sack 3 lands, you get 4 3/3s and a 2-1. Is that at all interesting? Is that going to win the game?
I think you lose most of those games. I think it's interesting. The one thing I would say about it before we dismiss it is you didn't play anything on your turn 2 in your scenario. And so that maybe lets us play, you know, an explore-like effect or the blue-green instant version because we have an open slot. And then the second thing is a lot of time, so we can get 4/4s is what I'm saying. And then the other thing that to consider is a lot of times decks with Devastating Summons played, I guess now we have 8 of these effects, where we play a goblin that gives them haste and, you know, +1/+1, oh, until end of turn. This is sort of like 9 through 12 maybe of that version. So it's like, all right, if we can't Devastating Summons and give them haste and attack right away, we don't give them haste, but we get another, you know, a 2-2 and a bunch of 3/3s or 4/4s or whatever they are. So maybe in that sense, it's like, it gives us enough of a effect to kind of have these cheaty openings where on turn 3, we're presenting some kind of clock right away. Even still, I think removal has gotten good enough that that's, I don't think that's good enough, but maybe.
Well, I mean, if you have 5 mana or whatever, and you can go Seagate Stormcaller into Devastating Summons into Goblin Bushwhacker or Reckless Bushwhacker, that is most likely lethal. But you have to make it to that turn, of course.
Yeah.
In Historic, there's the dual Caster Mage combo deck that involves playing this card into Neoform. Sack Seagate Stormcaller, you get a dual Caster Mage with the first Neoform to resolve, copy the Neoform on the stack, and then just keep getting dual Caster Mages until you wind up getting some pretty funny-looking Magic cards to see high-level tournament play. But there's the card that gives all your creatures haste at 3 CMC and a card that gives you an extra combat step, Combat Celebrant. I'm blanking on the other one. Tuck-Tuck something...
That's not just some card. That's another hit from Zendikar Rising, possibly a future brew around. Tuck Tuck Rebel for the 1/3 defender.
Yeah, of course, we don't have access to Dual Caster Mage. This is not historic that we're discussing.
Yeah, Dual Caster Mage in a weird spot where it's neither Pioneer nor Modern legal. So don't have access to that combo even in Modern. Not that it would be good in Modern were it legal necessarily.
Did it come from like a Commander deck or where did it come from?
Yeah, it was a Commander deck and people were thinking it would see Legacy play. Not good enough for that, obviously. But Historic, I think it's found a really cool slot where it's actually pretty good.
Yeah, entered Historic via the Jumpstart expansion. So yeah, that is, I guess that's the other next question. The pedigree of Seagate Stormcaller, to the extent that there is one, is this Historic combo deck. When you look in Modern, you don't find any results with Stormcaller. You know, we'll talk about one or two lists. But Historic, I mean, it's seen Mythic Championship level play. Is there any combo that you guys can think of? I guess this is more of a question for David, since you've been working on this card. Is it like the unique properties of Dual Caster Mage that make this Neoform combo possible, or can we find suitable replacements?
Well, you know, I had my super convoluted, had to work much harder to generate Neoform combo that this goes into. And I think I sort of pitched that maybe like 6 or 7 weeks ago. The problem is you don't just get to play this super clean two card combo win where it does it all by itself. So you need all this other nonsense. And so I found that deck to be really hard to put all the pieces together. So in that sense, yeah, that's a pretty big problem.
Yeah, you needed like Narumiha, and then you needed Spark Doubles. You had Lutries, but they didn't work because you can't like Lutri doesn't copy unless it was cast. So
right. So this can copy a Neoform that is sacking a 3-mana creature to start your combo, but it can't sack itself. That's the problem in Historic. It's its own target, so you always know you're going to have a 2-mana body around that Neoform works with. The 2-mana card needs to fetch a 4-mana card in Pioneer, so it can never actually be the copier if it's going to be the sacrifice fodder for Eldritch Evolution. So you just need that one extra piece, and that one extra piece is actually like, it doesn't seem like it's much more, but it actually adds significant amounts of requirements to the pieces to go off.
Yeah. If anyone's curious about this list and doesn't want to re-listen to the past 2 months of episodes, I'll put a link in the show notes to... we did a write-up on this deck, the Neoform Stormcaller combo list that Dave was talking about. It's on faithlessbrewing.com, and I'll drop a reference to it in the show notes here. So that being said, let's take a look at some new lists. So David, you've gone back to the drawing board, got a few new ideas here. Where do you want to start, Pioneer or Modern?
I'm going to start in Pioneer. I think this card is more of a Pioneer level card. Now, obviously, it gets more attractive as you get into older sets because it's copying more powerful cards. Obviously, copying Ancestral Recall or Time Walk is more powerful than copying Shock. It is more powerful to copy Lightning Bolt. As we said, that Modern has Lightning Bolt and Pioneer does not. The problem is that Modern has Snapcaster Mage, and we just talked about how much better Snapcaster Mage is in this card. So unless there's a weird sequence, a combo deck like Dan's referring, I'm not sure that we have a lot of incentive to explore that much. I put together a little Modern list, although I don't really believe in it. So in Pioneer, we have, like I said, my Lutri list. I'm not going to propose it to you guys because we'll just talk about decks you might be considering playing. I'm going to play the Lutri list this week. and I'm going to have a great time. So the first thing I was interested in doing was playing this in a sort of blue-black control, kind of a softer version of the Day's Undoing list. So this has 2 Day's Undoing. This has 2 Salundi Vision, so another dual face card to help find the Day's Undoing if necessary. Seagate Stormcaller is attractive in this list because we have so many cheap spells. So it can just be a card advantage engine with Opt. It can be a very good sort of control breaker because it can target Duress or Thoughtseize against other decks that are trying to cast, you know, counter magic, etc. It can copy Eliminate, and then we're already playing Brazen Borrower, and this is a card that actually can copy Brazen Borrower's bounce effect. There's sort of a hidden 2-mana instant in this deck. So this is kind of a modified version of a list that we've liked before. I've been tooling around with the list, changing a few cards around. I actually kind of like the look of this list quite a bit. I actually think the early tempo of having a 2-1 might be something the deck was looking for, and I didn't even consider it until I started sort of experimenting with like Seagate Stormcaller frameworks.
Yeah, I mean, Pioneer, there's just no point comparing to Snapcaster. We don't have it. We have Mission Briefing, and I'm sure Seagate Stormcaller is as good as Mission Briefing, or at least I sure hope so. I like the cling to dust. I mean, this means that in the late game, you top deck a late Seagate Stormcaller, you look at your graveyard and wish you had a Snapcaster, but with cling to dust and six mana total, you can at least get some value out of your Stormcaller. In addition to, yeah, these doubling up on Thoughtseize, Fatal Push, Opt, these are all good targets. Much less Eliminate and Drown in the Locks flexibility shines here.
Yeah, so Eliminate is picked over other spells because it allows you to kill a creature and... do you always have to pick the mode for Eliminate? Or Eliminate is not a modal spell. So you can, for instance, blow up a Teferi and a 0-4 wall against Jeskai. So Eliminate allows you to always... or increase the chance that the copied version is going to have another target.
Would you say that this list is kind of putting Seagate Stormcaller to the Snapcaster test, where if you just delete that creature from the list, it's a mostly functional blue-black spell-based control with the Narset finish. You don't need Seagate Stormcaller, but we're basically sort of testing out whether it can fulfill that Snapcaster role of just being like a pretty good two-for-one-ish type creature to, you know, get you a little tempo, get you a little something to do early.
Yeah, so what I've found with this kind of shell is that we often dominate the late game, and what we're trying to do is like not die because we're so far behind. So I'm actually really excited because this kind of shores up our early game against aggro decks. The red decks were the ones that had the worst kind of matchups for this. You just have this really tempo positive play where you play this, you kill two of their creatures, and you have a blocker for future creatures or something that forces them to burn a burn spell on this to get through. Also, it kind of helps solve the problem, Dan, you were describing where you say, oh man, you end up with this in the late game and it sucks. You need other spells. Well, we have Days Undoing that actually fills our hand. So whatever effects are good, we'll likely have them again. So Fatal Push is a card that's good after you refill your hand. You're likely to have a super tempo positive play if you don't get to Days Undoing with Narset or whatever. So let's just say when you Days Undoing with Narset or Notion Thief, you're way ahead. If you just have to like Days Undoing normally, this really helps you win back tempo because if Thoughtseize or Duress is what's good, now all of a sudden you're attacking your opponent's hand or you're blowing up two of their creatures, etc. So you kind of get rewarded for refilling your hand with a bunch of stuff.
Also, you're saying that on turn two of the value Days Undoing, Seagate Stormcaller lets you jump out of the gates real fast.
Yeah. Or let's say you do your Days Undoing thing, you flash a Notion Thief and do it, and you've drawn 14 cards, but your opponent has like a better board, so you know, you have to block your Notion Thief or they kill your Narset, so you don't have the lock established, and you tend to be low in life because this deck is pretty reactive. That next turn after you play your Seagate Stormcaller, you cast your Fatal Push and Eliminate, you just kill four creatures and you have a blocker in play. You can stabilize against a pretty wide board without having to play any sweepers main, which I no longer am.
I'd love to see some kind of bounce effect that this Seagate Stormcaller could copy.
Besides Brazen Borrower, or?
Well, I suppose. I mean, yeah.
Petty Theft, I mean.
Brazen B is best in class.
Yeah, it doesn't, like, get the... The thing is, that's a 4-mana play, and it's only really great if they have exactly two things you want to bounce, which is not often true in Pioneer on turn four. If it were like just like Boomerang, if Boomerang were legal in Pioneer, you could just bounce two lands. I'd be happier with that. But I guess we don't have that.
I'm not understanding what your critique is. Well, so Void Snare is a card that requires you to have two cards in play again. You just said that won't be the case.
No, I'm just saying that I wish there were... It would feel more synergistic to me if we had some way to like proactively just like give bounce value is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I mean, that's with the thing in the ice. So there's one thing main and another thing side. And that's a card that is also very sweet. Bouncing your own Seagate Stormcaller is like drawing a full extra card. It also, if you get to trigger your thing in the ice and then Days Undoing, you're effectively wrathing the board.
Yeah. One thing also I want to point out about this deck is that the Seagate Stormcaller seems to jump up in value a lot post-sideboard where, you know, double Aethergust is actually pretty good. Double Noxious Grass is good. Double Legion's End is good. Double Heartless Act. Double Duress, double Mystical Dispute, not good. Doesn't even work at all, actually.
Yeah, but one of the reasons why these sideboard cards are the way they are is exactly what you're saying, Damon, is we're trying to find cards that we can really like exchange full permanence for. So yeah, you never have to side it out. It's good against control and it's good against aggro. Doubling up, you know, these 2-mana cards that basically destroy a permanent means you're going to get a lot of value out of it.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know how the stack is ordered. I think if you cast a Heartless Act copied, you can order it so that the first Heartless Act removes all the counters from your thing in the ice, and then the second one, and then the trigger resolves. So like the copy trigger and the Heartless Act trigger, or the remove a counter trigger from the thing in the ice, will go on the stack at once. You can have your copy trigger resolve first, resolve target thing in the ice, remove all the counters, and then the trigger will flip it.
Oh, you just already put the thing in the ice trigger and the storm Seagate Stormcaller trigger on the stack.
Yeah.
And you trigger correctly.
So you so you only need to do one spell to flip it all of a sudden. So that's a thing that I'm, that's why I have two Heartless Act on the side. That's kind of your like anti-aggro package, or anti-whatever, Orzhov Bogles.
So you're saying you can do that because you're choosing the same mode. Like, you can't change the modes when you're making a copy. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay.
I think I would love to try this list. I think I'd play a few more Drown in the Lock, just for the reason that it has the flexibility that you have keep your counterspell density high against decks where you really need to have access to that sort of effect. But also seems like, you know, Drown in the Lock, Seagate Stormcaller actually seems reasonable. You can target the, make sure the lower CMC target gets killed first, and then it bumps the CMC for the next one up by one.
Oh, that's really clever. I didn't think of that. Yeah, I guess my concern was just like, obviously, with Days Undoing, it's not great post. And then if you're going to be copying Cling to Dust, maybe you'll be exiling enough cards that it's weak. But yeah, I mean, you know, Damon and I have fooled around with this type of shell before. You can tweak a lot of numbers, a lot of knobs. I think the key is to just increase your one mana drop. So I added a Duress. I'm playing the full four opt and one Cling. I think you want to do that. So I'm pretty confident in the 14 one mana spells. And then you can kind of pick and choose what you want to do in terms of the other ones. Maybe Neutralize isn't even that useful anymore. Maybe Drown the Lock is just straight up better. You know, is something I'm thinking of. Maybe you don't want the Hero's Downfall. There's a lot of things you can tweak. I wanted just unique effects in my mind because you have the two Saloon Divisions. So you can kind of find these unique effects. You can find the one, quote unquote, hard counter spell with Neutralize, but that might not be necessary. Maybe you do want one Sweeper with two Saloon Divisions, so you can always find it. Maybe you want one Heartless Axe, so you can always reduce your thing in the ice to zero, and if you have one other spell, it flips. There's a lot of different ways you can build, and because you have Seamgate Stormcaller to copy whatever, that means each individual one that has one extra Duress, if you get to Stormcaller, that's amazing against, you know, Jeskai Luka, etc.
All right. So the next list you have sticks with blue and black, but adds red to the mix.
So we know that there is a red-black sort of Pyromancer list. I love Young Pyromancer, but that deck is really bad. And I just keep beating it with all my crappy experimental decks, and it does poorly in all the tournaments. And so I'm with everybody out there. Let's play Young Pyromancer. Let's not play Arcanist. let's just give up the ghost. Arcanist sucks. It's bad, and maybe it's great in Legacy. I'll defer to whoever. If you get to counter Brainstorm, or if you get to copy Brainstorm, or if you get to copy Ancestral Recall, I'm in for that. But so let's abandon that. Let's play blue just for Seagate Stormcaller. And let's play Archfiend's Vessel, which helps us get paid off for Village Rites, which is a sweet card to copy with Seagate Stormcaller. And in a pinch, Seagate Stormcaller can also be the fuel for your Village Rites. So you don't need any other card. This is a Lurrus list, so all of our permanents are two mana, and it's just four Seagate Stormcaller, four Young Pyromancer, three Kroxa, four Citrus Supplier, and three Archfiend's Vessel.
Village Rites is black instant, sack a creature, draw two, but you're saying that because the sacrifice a creature has already been paid once, you don't have to pay it again?
Correct. So on turn three, you can just, on an empty board, let's say there's nothing else in play, you just play your Seagate Stormcaller, and you tap a black mana, and you draw four cards.
So you spent two cards, but you drew four. Then you go to discard. That's pretty good.
it's probably you did something on turn one and two with your deck full of Lurrus targets. It's also worth noting Claim to Fame is a card that you can both copy with Seagate Stormcaller, or you can claim back a Seagate Stormcaller. It immediately sets up a trigger, and then you can cast another spell after that, including Fame, if you really wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, for reference, the Village Rites Seagate Stormcaller thing, you go up plus two cards for a total of three mana. Ancestral Recall goes up two cards for one mana, and in Canlitter, I'll frequently Merchant Scroll for it, which is actually the same ratio.
this is the most convoluted comparison. Damon sees everything through the lens, so this is like his one mother tongue. Blue Moon, Canlitter decks.
All I'm saying is that going up two cards for three mana is a very good rate.
And you just have a lot of fodder around. You know, Archean's Vessel, you want to go to the graveyard. Citrus Supplier, you want to go to the graveyard. Kroxa is headed to the graveyard anyway. You might as well just push him off the cliff. Young Pyromancer's making little tokens. So it sort of has the red-black shell, but instead of playing a bunch of terrible cards, we replace those with Seagate Stormcaller because we're going to find out if it's better than Arcanist. If it's worse than Arcanist, it's one of the worst cards ever printed. So I'm hoping it's a little better than that.
This is a list where Arcanist tends to be pretty good, is the sad thing.
I mean, it's a list where Arcanist has a lot of synergy, but my experience playing against red-black Lurrus has been exactly what David's describing. Like, they do all this stuff, they set it all up, and then a bunch of turns later, you know, you win, and I don't know what they did, but they they went through a lot of their deck and they lost.
Also, the one thing that that comes up a lot, surprisingly, is Arcanist has a lot of anti-synergy with Kroxa. The red-black list does not fill its graveyard that fast unless they specifically find a bunch of Citrus Suppliers and put them in their own graveyard. A lot of times, Arcanist just eats cards in their graveyard. Seagate Stormcaller does not do that. It goes to the graveyard itself. It never exiles anything, even when it copies these spells. So your graveyard is just a lot richer. So Kroxa flashing back multiple times in a game is possible, whereas I feel like in the normal red-black list, the first time it comes back is probably the only time, unless the game goes super long.
Do you have any interest in cards like Cathartic Reunion or Collective Brutality, Lightning Axe? These are all cards that, you know, have uses. They're good enough, whether for Modern or Pioneer, in some situations, and they somewhat interact favorably with Seagate Stormcaller.
Yeah, I thought about the Cathartic Reunion. I think it was in the first list I even pitched when this card was spoiled. I just think it doesn't affect the board, and so trying to go longer with these lists is a bad idea because all these Urion shells are just so powerful on turn 4, 5, and 6. You need to get your card advantage before then. A 4-mana play that draws a bunch of cards is fine. I mean, that's quite good, but it also is a very bad top deck if you don't have enough cards in your hand. There's just too many things that can go wrong. Collective Brutality is a card that should maybe go in the sideboard. It just depends on how afraid of aggro decks you are. I do think, yeah, obviously, I think your point is well made, Dan, that it's very good when you're copying it if you get to do the full kit and caboodle. I'm not that in love with a few of these sideboard cards. You could switch them out. You could get rid of like a Magma Spray and a Feed the Swarm or something, and you'd be well served there. The problem, again, is just there aren't that many aggro decks. You'd just be doing that for mono red. You're going to maybe play that once a league. The -2/-2 isn't actually that powerful against most other decks in all of Pioneer. So,
right.
And Lava Axe, I'm not as much a believer in.
Okay, last question then. What about Opt? If we're going to splash blue, Opt seems to work with everything else going on. You know, it's good with Young Pyromancer, good with Kroxa, good with Stormcaller.
So Opt and Seagate Stormcaller actually adds the sneaky cost of blue-blue to your deck. And so blue is a light splash. It's not easy to do. I dinked around with a stupid mana base my whole lunch hour. To get the numbers where I wanted, and it still is a pretty bad mana base. So I never want to have to require a blue-blue mana cost. Although I agree, Opt would be awesome.
Yeah, this deck is pretty mana-intensive in the first few turns. You really don't want to take time off to be casting Opt. And then there are just games where you need to jam Kroxa as fast as possible to have any chance.
Yeah.
All right, so hopefully Stormcaller can outperform Arcanist. We'll see. This is the only Arcanist shell. So I don't know. This is either like the softball interview question for Seagate Stormcaller, or it's like, you know, you got to take this man's job and just prove that you're the best card suited. We'll see. So that's Pioneer. Do you want to venture into Modern?
So this is a super speculative list. Basically, the interaction I'm interested in is Seagate Stormcaller plus Neoform. So again, we don't require any other creatures. Neoform is sacrificing Seagate Stormcaller in this exchange. Find Spike Feeder and Heliod that turn. So you find the combo by itself and you gain infinite life that turn. So the rest of the shell is very similar to the Collected Company list that we talked about 2 weeks ago, was it, Dan? We had a wonderful article written on our website that this was the deck to beat. Aspiring Spike was not so sure, and it turned into a deck that's become very popular, and we keep seeing multiple lists showing up in top eight. So I'm not saying it is the deck to beat in Modern, but it is certainly among the better decks in the format. So because we know that interaction is something that has pedigree, as Dan likes to say, I'm interested in the shell for that reason. We are splashing blue. because both Neoform and Seagate's from Color Blue, so you make your mana a little worse, and you are kind of missing out on the sort of value collected companies. I don't know how important those are. Having watched the games, the collecting company is always just trying to find the combo anyway. To increase the density of spells that we have to copy, I went up to the 4 Eldamri's Call. So this plus Eldamri's Call obviously finds whatever pieces you need. And then I even added a Manamorphose just because I felt like we needed another target. Maybe we're still even short targets. We only have 9.
A green Manamorphose. You don't see that very often.
Yeah, I mean,
you can call red on your Utopia Sprawl and cast for red.
Thank God.
What I find so cool here is that you mentioned that I guess you both have the combo, but actually there's 2 combos here. One is Heliod plus Spike Feeder, which requires 0 mana and gives you infinite life, which leads to all sorts of weird grifter situations, as we've seen. or if you have more time on your hands, you can just get a Ranger Captain plus Heliod, grab a Walking Ballista, and win the next turn. And you can use the Ranger Captain to clear the way for, I guess, removal spells. So that's a pretty interesting. I'm not sure when you would want to go for the like delayed win versus immediate win, immediate infinite life, given the choice.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to mention the second combo, Damon, because I know you get upset when I start talking about the 2 combos. But
this is at heart a double combo list. There's no way around it.
Exactly.
It's kind of the same combo, though.
And then you even have the ability to just get a Skyclave Apparition. You know, we just talked about how good it is. So, you know, you just have this like pseudo ability to tutor for it almost at any time. And, you know, sometimes that's the card you need.
Concern that I have is that you're now talking about a list that is 60 cards and 4 of those cards are Neoform. You're not going to draw them with Seagate Stormcaller all the time. So are they going to do anything for you? And the way that the creature's suite sort of works out is that there's not a ton of creatures that you're happy to sacrifice. You know, nothing can actually fetch the Walking Ballista itself. That's a 0 drop. So Neoform just can never find Ballista unless you're going via Ranger Captain. But like the 2 drops, Conclave Mentor, you don't really want to sacrifice that if you can get away with it. Not a ton of 1 drops either. There's 5 1 drops that you could sack to get a 2 drop, but your 2 drops aren't really worth it. So I'm a little worried about the Neoforms.
Yeah, I agree. I think like when the deck works well, it's going to be awesome. And you're just going to have a bunch of other times where you have like 2 Neoforms in hand and like an Arbor Elf in play. And it's going to be bad times.
All right. Well, this is something to noodle on a little bit. I do like Neoform. This was the very first card that we ever featured on this podcast. So it's got a bit of sentimental value. But we'll have to see. You know, this is a proven concept and we're taking that beautiful picture and just mucking it all up with this silly CA Stormcaller nonsense. We will let you know, dear listeners, how that all turned out. Just to round out the discussion, I did a little digging to see what has this card done so far in Modern, and the answer is almost nothing. There's an Is It Wizards list that, Damon, you've picked out a couple weeks back as your pick of the week. This came from Darshik, one of our patrons. A cool list. Do you guys feel like this is a potential good home for the Stormcaller? It is here as a 4 of alongside Snapcaster Mage.
Yeah, I love this list.
Yeah, the card Boomerang, as we've discussed, is a pretty sweet interaction, and this is the only list that we've discussed so far to feature it.
The list doesn't really have that many spells in it. That's what's so interesting. One of my longtime complaints about the Wizard Tribe is that so many wizards assume you're like a spells deck that you almost can't play Wizard Tribal. But Darshik managed to build a deck that was like 21 creatures, 15 spells, 4 other vials, and made that work. The eligible spells that you could copy with the Seagate Stormcaller are, you know, basically just burn spells, ops. There's a couple of Manamorphos here, the 1 Boomerang. And then you got the 4 other vials to make the Stormcallers a little more tricky. And of course, the 4 and the Bond, Dean of Iteration.
Yeah, actually, I really like the ability to other vial remand. So they cast a spell, you remand it. Of course, you let the remand resolve. If they counter the remand or do something else, you know, they remand their own spell in response, you can flash this. Oh, no, that doesn't work. Well, you have Snapcaster Mage to do that, I guess.
So you want to add remands to the list?
No, there are remands in this list.
There's remands in the updated list, but not in the original 5-0 list.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at the proposed update.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, I was talking to Darshik about like future directions, and they'd suggested a pretty sweet iteration. I'll post both lists for reference in the show notes. And yeah, the only other real result was a Jeskai Tribal Flames, Geist of St. Traf, Stoneforge deck. And this is one that I played during our Cleansing Wildfire week. It was kind of a precursor to Aspiring Spikes I think he came up with the shell originally, but as he kept iterating on it, he found like a better version of the Jeskai Cleansing Wildfire that ignored the whole Geist, Tribal Flames, Storm Color aspect, which I think was correct. But a couple players did 5-0 with the deck. I played it to a 4-1 and a 2-3. And I really liked Wildfire, I liked Geist, I liked equipment, but I didn't think that the Stormcaller was doing it. So what am I trying to say? What's the takeaway from all this? Well, the card is either really underexplored or really underpowered with so few results after so many months now. But I guess we will have to find out and see for ourselves.
Agreed.
Yeah, we will have to get to calling a lot of storms out there in the queues while hopefully we have sunny skies at home. So, until next week, and we can't wait to figure out what our brewing card of the week will be that you, the listeners, can help us choose.
Yeah, I'm going to be in the polls all weekend, challenging votes, and we'll get to the bottom
clearing
of this.
Clearing out the hang chads.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. All right, take care, gentlemen. Have a good week.
All right, take care.
And with that, we have reached the end of episode 83 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. Thanks for hanging out with us. We hope you enjoyed the show. Deck lists for this week can be found at faithlessbrewing.com. There is a link in the episode description that will take you right to it. If you'd like to support our show, you can do so by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. Patreon is a fantastic way for fans and audiences to connect with artists and support them directly without middlemen or sponsors or that kind of thing. Even a pledge of $1 a show goes a huge way towards helping us keep the lights on, pays for our professional editor, and lets us keep bringing you this show week after week. You also get some slick benefits for becoming a supporting member. Discord access if you want to come hang out with us throughout the week, talk shop, pick around some brews, play in our community leagues. You get bonus content in the form of extended show notes. You can send in questions for us to answer on air, help us choose topics for future episodes. And at the higher tiers, if you're interested in Faithless Brewing merchandise, we have custom tokens and playmats as well. Other ways you can support the show include leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. That helps new listeners find our show, helps us climb those rankings in the algorithm. And likewise, you can follow us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG. That's all for this week. Stay safe out there and happy brewing.